Hi everyone, and welcome to Ask the Horse Live. I'm your host, Michelle Anderson, Digital Managing Editor of The Horse. Tonight, we're talking about feeding recreational horses. This live event and podcast is brought to you by Nutrina. Our recreational horses aren't elite athletes that are going to cover 50 miles on the trail tomorrow or compete in a jump-off, but they aren't quite pasture puffs either. So what's the best way to manage their body condition while also ensuring that they're getting the gut support and vitamins and minerals that they need? To help answer these questions, we're joined tonight by Dr. Claire Tunis, an independent equine nutrition consultant and owner of Clarity Equine Nutrition, and Abby Keegan, who is a technical services equine nutritionist with Cargill Nutrition. Welcome to you both.
Hi, everyone.
Good evening.
So I want to start with Claire. Can you tell our audience a little bit about your experience balancing equine diets and your work with recreational horses?
Yeah, absolutely. So I work with a lot of recreational horses. I have a lot of owners of recreational horses who really feel strongly that they want to make sure that their partners are well fed and getting everything they need. And so we do a lot of diets for those horses, and looking at, you know, what they should be fed and helping them select the perfect, you know, the kind of correct commercial products that work with the type of forage that they're feeding and the type of housing that they're in, whether they're out on pasture or stalled. So I work with a lot of those kinds of horses, and each one's slightly different, and, you know, generally there are some similarities, but you know, there's a lot of horses in the United States that fall into that recreational horses category, so I certainly work with my fair share.
And Abby, can you tell us about your work in equine nutrition with Nutrina?
Sure. So I've been working in the field consulting for, gosh, almost 18 years now. Now my role primarily is around thinking about what research we want to do, what product, you know, updates, new product designs, and then really thinking about how do we communicate that to, you know, our customers, our consultants, horse owners and veterinarians as well. So spend a lot of time around that. And then I do quite a bit in terms of kind of some of those deeper dive consultations where help is needed with some of the young growing horses and some of the metabolic cases as well. So certainly a lot of opportunity around, again, as Claire mentioned, that longevity piece and, you know, how do we feed these horses correctly throughout the different stages of their life. And, you know, one of those, I have an old show horse here. I tend to collect the geriatric herd, but he doesn't do a whole lot anymore. But, you know, how do we feed him appropriately as he's kind of become one of these recreational horses where he just rides a few times a week? So, yeah.
Well, I want to give everyone a quick overview of our Ask the Horse Live format. We're going to be starting with questions that everyone submitted during registration. If you have a question that you'd like to ask live or would like clarification on a response, you can enter it in the chat window in front of you if you've joined us on your computer. We're going to do our best to get to as many of your questions as possible. If you're listening to our archive or podcast and are interested in joining us live next time, you can register to receive announcements at thehorse.com or visit thehorse.com/askthehorselive. So with that, we'll go ahead and jump in and get started. Claire, the first question's for you, and I think it's a good place to start when we're talking about nutrition. How do you define what a recreational horse is?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a fairly broad definition, I think. I think like Abby was saying that she collects geriatrics. I was sitting there listening to her, you know, introducing herself and realizing, you know, I guess I would say I'm a recreational rider with, you know, a somewhat recreational horse. So what I do in my riding is recreational at this point, right? I mean, I share a large pony with my daughter. She, you know, competes him at the lower levels, and I sort of dabble in lower level dressage and go trail riding. And I was sitting here going, oh, I guess I'm a recreational rider, and he's, you know, somewhat of a recreational horse. But if you know, look to the National Research Council, you know, they have some guidelines, and funnily enough, they actually have a table in their guidelines that kind of gives a hypothetical weekly look at what a recreational horse does and the energy expenditure associated with that. And so, you know, what they describe as a recreational horse is, say, on Monday is doing 45 minutes of arena riding, walk, trot, and canter. And the next day it's doing maybe a 45-minute trail, mostly walking. Maybe on a Wednesday it doesn't get worked. Thursday, 45 minutes of riding in the arena again, walk, trot, and canter. Friday, no work. You know, Saturday, 2 hours of trail riding, mostly walking, and Sunday, no work. And they go on to say that, you know, they have other definitions of work as well, and they put recreational riding in the light work category, and it also shows up in the moderate work category. So I would say, for example, our personal family horse who works 5 days a week and is doing lower level dressage and jumping, I mean, he's definitely in that light to moderate category. I mean, he works pretty hard. I mean, we're not trying to go out and compete at any particular level. We don't have any big show goals or anything. We're just enjoying the journey and enjoying the ride, right? But he's working fairly hard. There are other horses I know who get out for a trail ride on a Saturday and that's it, right? That's also a recreational horse. So there's a pretty broad spectrum of horses that fall in this category, but they're typically not going to be the horses that are aiming at competition at the higher levels. They're not in a super dedicated, you know, focused kind of competition program. To me, those are more your performance horses. So hopefully that's somewhat as clear as mud, right?
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned those weekend warrior horses,
right,
Claire, the ones that just, you know, once a week. So my question would be to Abby, when you're looking at the feed label on the Nutrina bags, where is this recreational horse? Is it that light work horse, moderate work?
That's such a good question. To me, you know, I would be looking at that maintenance requirement on the label, on the feed tag, or the light work category. But to be completely honest, so the interesting part about feed tags is generally those are written in terms of caloric consumption. And I mean, this kind of gets into a whole nother topic, but it doesn't take into full account of what you have for forage. And so I think that's why there's so many people who, you know, maybe do have a horse that is in that light work category, recreational horse that they're doing a little bit more with, such as, you know, kind of that description that Claire read off. But they've got really, really good quality forage. And so it's providing a majority of those calories. And so generally the feeds, you know, that are designed with kind of this 0.5% of body weight, or you think of that 5 to 6 pounds per 1,000-pound horse recommendation for that kind of maintenance to light work category, that's probably too many calories for a lot of them. And so we start to talk about these diet balancers coming into play, which I'm sure we'll get into more discussion about those. So.
Well, Abby, the next question is for you, and it's from Mary in Georgia. And she says her horses are fat and seem healthy on pasture. She wants to know how she determines if they are receiving enough vitamins and minerals, though.
Good question. So, yeah, they're getting plenty of calories from the pasture, and you're asking the right question of are they receiving everything they need? I like to use the analogy of what I call fat, slick, and shiny, and I'm doing air quotes here, and you guys can laugh. But how many of you guys have ever heard somebody say that? Like, they look at their horse and, well, he's fat, slick, and shiny. He must be healthy. Have you guys heard that before?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Like, it's so common. And so to Mary's point, right, the horse is receiving plenty of calories, but we can't visibly see by looking at a horse if they've got enough vitamins or trace minerals coming in. And the other one that's often forgotten is the amino acids. So after analyzing thousands of forage samples, we actually have an amazing forage lab up at our Minnesota lab facility, and thousands and thousands of samples come in from all across the US. And there is no perfect forage in terms of meeting all of the optimal requirements that I would look to for even a horse that is just, you know, doing recreational riding. So the way that you would determine that, I guess, is again, you've got all your calories, but you've got to find something that's basically meant to complement that pasture. So you might look to, as I mentioned, that diet balancer type of design where it's super concentrated with those vitamins and trace minerals. And it's also supplying those amino acids that would be missing as well. You know, the only other thing to think about, the gold standard way essentially, you know, would of course be to analyze the pasture, send it off to a lab. and then work with a nutritionist to really define exactly what your specific pasture is missing.
Claire, our next question is for you, and it's from Justine in Salem, and she wants to know if it's okay to let horses eat hay between or before activities.
Yeah, right. And so this is something I used to be, you know, I was a good pony clubber back in the day. And, you know, one of the sort of rules of feeding we had in, back then was, you know, you don't, not supposed to do work, you know, after you've fed them, right? And we now understand that doing work on an empty stomach really increases your risk of things like gastric ulcers. And so, you know, while it's not, you don't want to be feeding large meals and going off and doing gallop sets, certainly for these recreational horses and really all horses, having some, you know, small amount of feed in their stomach is a good idea. And ideally that would be forage. And there's a number of reasons for that. Forage, you know, makes a nice fibrous mat that floats on the top of the stomach acid. It's a bit like a natural fiber doormat. And it's going to stop that stomach acid splashing around so much in their stomach, which is going to reduce the risk of squamous ulcers, which are ulcers that occur in the upper portion of the stomach. Forage also takes a little more chewing. And so the more they chew, the more they secrete saliva, and saliva has bicarbonate in it, so it buffers the stomach acid. And it's important to think back to how horses really evolved. And, you know, they really, in their natural setting, are eating for, gosh, 16 more hours a day. And, you know, when they eat, they are generating that saliva, which is helping to buffer the stomach acid. The stomach acid is produced almost constantly. And so it's sort of this beautiful system, right? They're constantly secreting stomach acid, so they're constantly buffering it by chewing all the time and pretty much constantly eating. And then we come along and meal feed them and kind of put a bit of a kink in that system. The other thing too is that generally after horses have eaten forage, they drink. So, you know, if you're out and about and trail riding and things and off, you know, you might not be moving at great speed, but you might be on your horse for quite a long period of time. You know, recreational riders are often in the tack for long hours out trail riding, and having forage, you know, in the system helps hold water and it helps encourage them to drink. So it helps you stay hydrated. So yes, you know, keeping, you know, allowing horses to eat hay before and between activity, I think is a good idea.
For my two trail horses, I keep hay nets with alfalfa in my trailer. And so when I'm tacking, I tie the hay bags up so they get to eat alfalfa before we go riding. And it's really changed their attitude at the trailer. And when we haul to a new place, they aren't looking around quite so much because they know they get out and then they get their special alfalfa treat before we hit the trail. And I think it's I have one really pretty hotsy mare, and it seems to really settle her to have something that she's eaten before we head out on the trail. So just that's my tip for
For sure. And I do the same thing. You know, our barn, sometimes I arrive sort of the end of the afternoon and they haven't been fed yet. We go out to ride after school and they haven't been fed since the morning. And so, you know, we have big muck buckets for, you know, mucking stalls and things into, but I'll go sweep some, you know, clean hay off the hay barn floor and just put a little bit of loose hay in a muck bucket and he'll eat out of that while we're grooming. And again, as you say, he's much happier in his work then, especially if the hay cart happens to come around in the middle of our ride. It really helps with that. Keep him focused on his work.
I do the exact same thing.
Heaven forbid if the hay cart.
If the hay cart drops alfalfa in the arena.
Yeah, and the barns are always feeding right about the time everyone gets there after work. So.
Yes. So yeah, you don't want to work them on an empty stomach. So.
No. Yeah, get that hay mat in there so the acid has something to chew on, air quotes.
Yep.
Abby, our next question is for you, and it's from Elaine in Virginia. And she has a 15-year-old Rocky Mountain horse that was diagnosed with Cushing's or PPID, but he's not insulin resistant. Is it okay to only feed him twice a day? Hay, that is.
Yeah, good question. So number one, I guess, great job working with your veterinarian, Elaine, to identify that your horse has PPID or Cushing's, but it's not.
15 is a little earlier than some people might find that.
Yeah, surprisingly, right? But it's become more and more common when we have veterinarians testing those ACTH levels and seeing where some of these horses are. So good job starting to identify that. And then also calling out, right, that he's not insulin dysregulated or insulin resistant at this point. So that helps us a little bit too. But so I would say, is it okay to give him hay just twice a day? I would say yes, but maybe with two kind of caveats. So if we're doing hay just twice a day, morning and night, with a certain allotment, number one, we've got to make sure he's got at least 1.5% of his body weight. So if he's a 1,000-pound horse, at least 15 pounds of hay per day minimum. And then secondly, that we're feeding it, if we're just doing it twice a day, in a way that's going to help him to eat it more slowly, right? So if we can use a small hole hay net, nibble net, whatever you want to call them, with the smaller holes, there's tons of work that's been done. Again, as Claire mentioned, that these horses are continuously secreting acid. So if we can have him chewing more throughout the day, slowing him down, again, not have these big spikes, and these horses as well. So I actually just I just had that my old show gelding that I was talking about. His name's Chester. He's 22, and I actually just last week had him had my veterinarian test his ACTH levels. And I know that they can, in the fall, they can definitely be up to three times as high, but his were still off the charts. So
Oh, wow.
we're t it's time to
Yeah.
we've nutritionally intervened, and he's done really well. But now it's time for some medical treatment as well. So.
So there is
I
a
think it's
point
a
where.
really.
Oh, sorry, Claire. I interrupted you there.
Oh, no worries. No, I was just going to say, I think actually this is a really interesting question to just awareness point, right, for this group of horses that we're talking about. Because I think a lot of our recreational horses, there is a large sort of senior horse component to this population. A lot of horses maybe have busy show careers and become recreational horses, right, as they get older. So I think it's really important for the owners of recreational horses to be aware that Cushing's is out there. And you mentioned 15 being fairly young, but they are seeing horses even as young as 8. Thing, and I know there's some contention there in the veterinary community, but it's not too young to be testing at 15. And it's a conversation I have with a lot of my senior horse clients, to be talking to their veterinarians about whether or not they should be testing their horses. And it's a surprising number that at this time of year do get. I had a client I just saw this morning, went and saw the horse this morning. History of navicular and had some hoof issues, and they were forward thinking enough to test it for Cushing's, and its ACTH values came out at 200. Well, three times normal is like 100, so this time of year, and as Abby mentioned, we do have a higher cutoff. But just to raise that awareness and get that people thinking about that, I think it's really important.
Yeah, I will add too. I'm not sure if Elaine was also wondering if it's okay to just give hay alone to her gelding. That is another thing to think about. So if he's maintaining weight, with the hay, again, feeding it in the nibble net, doing your best to make sure he's at least getting that 1.5% of body weight. If he's got good body condition over his ribs, then again, you might just choose something to easily balance the diet or balance the forage. Like, so my gelding that I was talking about, he actually weighs about 1,375 pounds. He's a large quarter horse. And so he actually just gets 2 pounds of Empower Top Line Balance with his hay, and then obviously Free Choice salt and water, but just a simple way to balance their diet.
We have a follow-up question from the live audience related to Cushing's horses. EC would like to know what some low NSC forage options are for increasing chewing time for a PPID and insulin-resistant horse who cannot eat hay because of dental or gut issues. So that's a couple challenges. You have dental issues on top of PPID. Claire, do you want to take a stab at that one?
Sure. I mean, there are some, just like hay pellets out there from varieties that we think of as being, generally lower in starch and sugar. So there are like Teff hay pellets. and you know, TEF is typically considered to be low and a C. And I say that with a slight hesitation in my voice because, you know, as Abby has probably seen with all the forage testing they've done, you know, there's no absolute guarantee, right?
Unless no
you
guarantee.
Test something, you really don't know, right? So I run into this a lot with people saying, oh, you know, TEF is low starch, low sugar. And I'll be honest, I've seen orchard hays that are lower than TEF and TEF that's higher than orchard. And, you know, really, unless you test, you don't know. But in general, we consider TEF to be a lower NSC hay. And so if you can find pellets from that variety, that may be a good option. There are feed companies out there that have chopped forages that are guaranteed low NSC. When we say low NSC, we're talking like 12% or lower. There are also some, senior feeds that are that low as well. So you could complete feed. So you could replace some of your forage intake with a high fiber complete senior feed for those horses. So there are some options out there. It's really just a matter of, you know, looking at all your feed labels and, you know, looking for products. And there are more and more, you know, forage replacement type products out there now that you could do. Beet pulp is considered a low NSC feed as long as it has no added molasses, and you can replace a fairly large amount of the, I think up to like 50% of the hay intake as beet pulp. Mm-hmm. So that's an option. Obviously that's not fortified, so you still need to have that balance or some source of, you know, equal type of vitamin mineral source in the diet. I'm not sure if Abby's aware of any others that I'm not thinking of.
Yeah. Another thing I've done is, so if you do have, this is going to sound like a lot of work, but I had a gelding, my first show horse, he lived to be 37 years old, and he was not able to consume, you know, forage or chew forage after a certain point, of course. And so I was very fortunate. My dad, we feed some cattle, and so he would clean out the grinder mixer. I would have hay tested, and then it would go into the grinder mixer and get ground into small pieces. And I would feed that to him along with, I think I fed Safe Choice Senior at the time, as about a 50-50 diet. So that's another way, you know, it is a pain, right? You've got to have the forage tested, but if you do that and have it chopped into smaller pieces, I have heard of really creative things. One gal actually took a lawnmower and she would mow over the hay prior to feeding it to her pony. So I thought that was pretty creative. I hadn't heard that one before, but I know there's some ways you can do that. But, you know, as Claire mentioned, oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, there's no end to what we horse people will do for our horses.
No, I love it. Love it. Yeah. So, but yeah, as Claire mentioned, you know, there are some senior products on the market. We make one called Pro Elite Senior. It's got a maximum of like 3% sugar, I think, and 9% starch, maybe, or not much. I've got those reversed. So it's really, really low, and you can utilize that with, you know, a little bit of beet pulp or some alfalfa pellets as well. So, but I think the other thing I will throw out there, the whole, you know, we have this 42-year-old pony that is obviously has Cushing's, and she is insulin dysregulated, and it depends on the individual horse. So, you know, we kind of use this magic, you know, 12% NSC. Realize that that is the best of our nutritionist's knowledge, right, from different trials. But there are individual horses who will vary. So some, you don't have to feel like you have to stick to that number in every case. Sometimes it's understanding with your veterinarian, you know, just how insulin dysregulated is this horse? Or are we completely insulin resistant, right? They're different. So something to think about.
So I heard Claire mentioned complete feeds. And then Bonnie in our live audience is wondering what a balancer is, because we've mentioned ration balancers. Claire, could you explain the difference between a complete feed, a ration balancer, and then a concentrate, which I don't think has been mentioned yet?
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. No, absolutely. And it's a great question. And it's so funny. As I said, I was out in the field today and I just had this conversation with somebody who's feeding a senior feed. And she said, yeah, because it's got all the vitamins and minerals in it. And I said, yeah, it does. It's a complete feed. And she looked at me a little like puzzled. And I said, it's a complete feed, meaning it also has all of the, you know, forage and fiber in there too. And the particular senior she was feeding, you know, is really designed to be fed as the complete diet, right? Not, no hay, no nothing else. And so we were looking at feed tags. She had a balancer in her feed room as well. And I said, hey, you know, look at this tag and then look at your balancer tag and look at things like the zinc and the copper and what have you. And I'm making these numbers up, but like, you know, the senior had a zinc of like 180 parts per million, and the balancer had a zinc of like 700 parts per billion. And, you know, the copper had a level of like 30 parts per million, and in the senior, and the balancer had one of like 200 parts per million. So the balancer is way more concentrated, has a far smaller serving size. And as Abby alluded to earlier, you know, they're really designed to just be the pieces that are missing in a forage-based diet, right? So they're providing that copper, that zinc, that vitamin E, the quality protein with the high levels of essential amino acids, the things that you're not going to get from your forage. A complete feed is the complete diet that the horse needs. It has all the vitamins and minerals in it as well, but it also has all the fiber, but the serving size is so much bigger because it's supposed to be everything the horse eats. And so all the vitamin minerals are much more dilute because the manufacturer is expecting you to feed, you know, 1.5% of body weight per day. Whereas with the balancer, they're expecting you to maybe feed, you know, 1, maybe 2 pounds per day. So they have a very different expected sort of serving size, if that makes sense. And then a concentrate is really anything that's providing concentrated nutrients, right? So oats can be a concentrate. Right? It's providing a concentrated source of calories, right? And a lot of it from starch mostly. So our concentrates can be individual ingredients, or you might say like a performance feed would be a concentrate, very concentrated source. It's energy dense. You might have like a 10-12% fat performance feed, and that would be an example of a concentrate. It's very concentrated in calories. It's probably got 1.5 times or more calories in it per pound than hay, so it's concentrated. But you can have, you know, protein supplements might fall into being a concentrate too. It's a protein concentrate, 38% protein or what have you. So that term is more, you know, it's concentrated nutrition. And I think of myself personally, when I think of concentrates, I'm thinking unfortified ingredients, but that's not necessarily totally accurate. That's how I personally think about it. I think of forages as being, you know, hay and grass and hay pellets, and, you know, beet pulp is a forage. They're unfortified. They just how they the plant grew in the field kind of thing. Concentrates I think of similarly a little bit. And then we have our complete feeds are manufactured and have everything in them that you need. And then the ration balances are, you know, heavily fortified, small serving size, almost supplements in a way, but they're, you know, 1 to 2 pounds per day.
So Claire, we have a question from Katya in Washington, and she wants to know, how do you ensure that a horse gets enough vitamins and minerals while not adding too many calories with something that's pre-mixed? So out of those options, what would you recommend to Katya?
I'm going to go with the balancer, right? Because its goal is not to add calories, right? We've already got enough. We've already met the horse's calorie needs. As Abby, like, I'm going to steal Abby's, you know, fat, slick, and shiny, right? It's already fat, slick, and shiny, right? We look at this horse and we say, this horse is in really nice weight and looks pretty good, right? I'm not struggling to keep weight on it. I can get to the ideal weight just feeding pasture or hay, but I know I'm missing the vitamins and minerals. So I'm going to go with my ration balancer because I don't need to add a ton of calories. I just need what's missing in the hay. So I just want my 1-2 pound a day serving size ration balancer.
So Abby, we have a question from Chandra in Montana, which is on the opposite end of the spectrum. And she said that she has been told she needs to, actually it's the same. I read it the other way. She has horses that need to lose some puff. How does she put them on a diet in cold winters in Montana? So how do you cut back on how much you're giving your horse when the weather is extremely cold?
Yeah, that's a good one. So good for her for identifying she's got a little bit of extra puff and needing to lose that. in those horses. So I think number one, you know, obviously she's identifying it's going to get cold. And the number one way to help these horses stay warm in the wintertime is to make sure they're chewing and fermenting forage, right? That they've constantly got something they're chewing on. And then those good microbes in their hindgut are working to break them down and sort of internally combust and heat the horse from the inside out, I like to say. So if we're going to try to help those particular horses lose weight, again, I would go back to what is their ideal body weight. So if that is 1,000 pounds, just for easy math, we're going to sort of limit their forage consumption to maybe, you know, if they've been on free choice hay, maybe we start at 2% of their body weight. We're going to weigh that out. We're going to give that to them in a hay net in the morning and then the other half in a hay net at night so they can slowly consume it still, right, throughout the day and continuously heat themselves. And then to balance out that forage, same concept. We're going to pull in that diet balancer. You know, I use Empower Top Line Balance on my horses at about, you know, that 1.5 pounds per day for that size of a horse. Claire, I don't know if you have anything else to add to that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big believer in, you know, if you have a horse going into the winter with a little too much weight, you know, let the cold weather help you a little bit with your weight loss needs, right? there's so much research out there now about how we're all a little anthropomorphic when it comes to worrying about our horses being cold and over blanketing, right? And I think there's that temptation. And on the opposite scale, if you have a horse that's going into winter, you have an older senior horse or a thinner skin type, thoroughbred type who's a little underweight, you know, blanketing can be your friend because they're not going to be burning calories to keep warm, and so the calories you're putting in are going to go into generating body mass. Conversely, if you've got the slightly overweight horses in the winter, you know, they're going to have to burn calories to keep warm. And so I'm not advocating you having your horses outside shivering in the cold at all, but you know, let nature do what nature does, right? Horses lose weight in the winter and they gain weight in the summer when they're on spring grass. And so if your horse is going into the winter a little overweight, you know, let the winter help you with that. And as Abby said, you know, make sure you're feeding your forage and what have you and meeting all those needs. But don't be tempted to, you know, throw blankets on and keep them overly warm. Let them burn some calories to keep warm.
Yeah. And I live in an area that can get pretty cold. It was actually 16 degrees earlier this week in the morning when I went out to feed. And I think in addition to the nutrition piece, the horse management piece of having just adequate shelter, and for us, especially where I'm at, a windbreak goes a long way to helping horses have more comfort without, you know, necessarily layering on the blankets. I have two that don't get any blankets and then one that does because she is in full work all winter and I need her to be able to dry. So that I can, I'm not right. In the barn for 4 hours trying to get her to dry out. But
yeah,
we have a question for Abby. It's from Jody in Florida, and she wants to know, how do you get your recreational horse to drink when away from home? She says she's tried molasses, Kool-Aid, and electrolytes, and none have helped.
Aren't those obnoxious? We can call them picky drinkers, right? my best advice, I guess, is, you know, once you've sort of identified a said picky drinker, if you can start, you know, if you know you're going to be leaving at the end of the week to head to a show or to go trail ride or whatnot, start ahead of time. So get them acclimated to whatever electrolytes, Kool-Aid, whatever it is you're going to use before you leave home, and get them used to drinking that with your water. And then it makes it an easier transition sometimes to, you know, get them drinking that same electrolyte with the new water once you get there.
Yeah.
Claire, then, any other tips you have?
You know what I'm going to say, Michelle, right? I'm going to plug salt.
I do.
Salt.
So I feed my horses more salt than I ever thought I would because of Claire.
Everybody forgets. Yeah, I don't know about you. I go in the, you know, the nicest of barns and there's no salt available. It's like the one thing everyone forgets about, right?
Yep. And I've fixed a number of picky drinkers. by just making sure they're getting, you know, adequate salt every day. You know, and I've worked with a number of horses that, you know, I used to live in Northern California and near, you know, some of the foothills of the Sierras. And when the weather would get nice in the spring, we'd have these horses that really hadn't done much all winter. And then we'd have these lovely 80 degree days, and their owners would take them on these ambitious trail rides up the mountain because it was beautiful out. And, you know, occasionally I'd meet with, somebody have a tie up episode. You know, all their horses wouldn't drink or what have you. And we have to remember that horses' sweat is very different from human sweat. Horses dump a lot of electrolytes in their sweat. It's very concentrated in electrolytes. And when you don't have a lot of circulating sodium in your bloodstream, you don't really have much of a thirst reflex. So if you sweat, if your horse is sweat really, really heavily and it's lost a bunch of sweat, its sodium level in its blood is now low. It doesn't have much of a thirst reflex. And I think that's where the saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. I think that's where that comes from, right? You could have been out on the trail for 2-3 hours. You get to a river, you stand in the river, and your horse is just looking off into the wide blue yonder, right? And you're like, dude, like, drink something. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know he should be thirsty. He's dripping in sweat, but he has no idea he should be thirsty because his sodium level is now dropped enough that he doesn't have much thirst reflex. So if you can give your horses adequate salt, you'll help keep that sodium level up. So even when they sweat, they still have enough circulating sodium to be like, yeah, you know what? I'm kind of thirsty. And it's that same thing. If you eat chips, you know, 10, 15 minutes later, you're like, oh, I need a glass of water or something else, right? So it's that same thing, right? So I fix a lot of these picky drinkers. I like to add a tablespoon of salt for every 500 pounds of body weight into their feed every day. And that just gives them their maintenance sodium requirement. We're not replacing any sweat losses there. We're just giving them their daily requirement for salt on a cool day doing no work. So then, you know, then in addition to that, if it's a super hot day, you might add electrolytes and things. But I generally find if I can do that for most average size horses, 2 tablespoons of salt a day, 365 days of the year, they will drink. And then if you have an issue with not drinking away from home, then, you know, that can be, if you live on a ranch and you go to a, you know, some event at a city equestrian center, maybe it's because the water's chlorinated and they're not used to drinking chlorinated water. Maybe they go from one well source to another well source and the amount of dissolved solids is different. So there's a different like saltiness to the water. That's where, you know, the molasses, the Kool-Aid, and things in the water, the apple juice that Abby was talking about, that's where that's really helpful. And I totally agree with her. You have to start that several days before you leave.
Yeah. And I would also recommend if you have, this is from experience, if you have a horse trailer that has a water tank in it and you're thinking by taking your own water, your horse is going to be happy and drink it, try that before you go somewhere. Because with mine, I think it got the water a little plastic tasting and he's like no, so then you end up away from home with a horse that won't drink. So check that out first to make sure. I ended up going to the grocery store and buying big jugs of water for him.
And I think that's a really good point. And you know, we often fill those things up with 30-50 gallons and leave them in the trailer, and goodness knows how long we leave it in there, right? You know, and so also drain it and refill it right before you leave so it is somewhat fresh. And I'd also just add, you know, if you are adding things to bucket water for your horse when you're away from home, please always give them a plain water as well, because you don't ever want to taint your water and not have just straight water available, because they may actually drink the straight water and, you know, you may have got yourself in more of a pickle than you started with. So I'm a big believer, if you're gonna hang a bucket with electrolytes in, always hang a bucket with plain water as well.
We have a follow-up question from Michelle in our live audience. She'd like to know what you would consider to be an appropriate amount of salt in a cold mountain climate.
I would be adding the same. I mean, we underestimate, I think. I don't know, Abby, if you would agree, but I mean, I think we underestimate sometimes how much horses sweat in cold weather if they're working.
Yeah, 100%.
Because we don't see the sweat. And we've seen that research in trailering too, right? You see horses come off of trailers. There's research showing that horses on a 14-hour trailer journey or whatever sweat I want to say it's as much as the speed and endurance day of a 3-day event. I mean, it's a lot of sweat, but you don't see it because there's been air movement over them as they come out of the trailer dry. And it's the same in the winter as you know, we don't. I mean, I case in point here, right? So I, I live in Arizona and it's super hot here and the horses are dripping in sweat in the summer. And we're suddenly down to sort of 75 and, you know, they're still sweating, but the wind was blowing the other day and he came in dry, but I know he was sweating. He was dripping sweat under his saddle pad, but he didn't have any sweat on his neck the way he does normally, but I know he was sweating.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. Everybody thinks about, you know, replacing them and making sure the horse has salt in the summertime when it's hot. But, you know, like when I was legging up and showing my Rainer a couple of winters ago and it was, you know, negative 20, but we still would ride and the horse would still sweat.
Right. And it's really cheap colic insurance, right? And we know the horses don't tend to drink as much when the water is cold. They don't like cold water. So their inclination to drink is down anyway because the water's cold. So if you can make them a little, you know, if you can get that sodium level up a little bit, you may make them that little bit more thirsty and be like, it's cold, but okay, fine, right? I'll drink it. And, you know, they've gone from maybe being out on pasture, on moist forage, to this time of year, we're starting to bring them in and put them in stalls. We see a lot of colic at this time of year because of the management changes that we're subjecting them to, going from fresh pasture and a damp diet to dry hay, and, you know, not moving as much as they were when they were in pasture, that kind of a thing. So I'm a big believer in salt 365 days of the year. Really, whether you live somewhere where, like I am now, and it's 75, 80 and beautiful, this is our, you know, winter is our time to shine here in Arizona, or whether you live in the northern climate, then you're going to get down to minus 20.
Well, and I have to say, because of Claire, I do give my horses additional salt every day, and even they have free choice blocks out in their turnouts. They have small blocks in their stalls, and I add the salt, and they still, because I thought once I added the salt, they'd stop using the free choice blocks, and they still use the free choice blocks on top of that. So I think I was really surprised by how much they actually needed once I started really paying attention. It was always kind of an afterthought, you know, oh, the block, throw it out there, you know, it'll be fine.
Right. Well, and a lot of horses, you know, and that's an important thing. A lot of people may think, well, I'm providing salt, but I've got a block. Very few horses eat much off a block, right? I mean, blocks, salt blocks are really designed for cattle that have rough tongues. Horses don't have rough tongues. They have smooth tongues. And quite honestly, the thought of standing and licking a block of salt is bleh. Anyway, but they don't tend to lick salt very much, right? So to get 2 tablespoons of salt off a block, you know, they'd have to go through a 2-pound block of salt a month. And when you say that to people, they go, oh, well, I'm not buying that much salt, block salt. So they're not using their blocks. But that's why I like to put it, you know, as like table salt in their grain or in whatever feed you're feeding, or a pan of loose salt. So they don't have to lick it. They can just go get it. But I like to do that 2 tablespoons. And like to your point, Michelle, that is their minimum. It's not necessarily all of what they're going to need. So yes, you should have some kind of block salt available as well.
Yeah, no, it's a lot more salt than I ever realized that they needed. So I thank Claire for that advice. Abby, we have a question for you from Newton in Utah. He wants to know, if you're not riding all that regularly, but on occasion you're riding more intensely for a few weeks, should you increase grain during that time that the horse is having more intense exercise?
You know, not necessarily, I guess. I think the bigger consideration as you would prepare to go and ride intensely is just to make sure that your horse is getting all of their nutrients and their optimal intake, right? So we can make sure that they stay out of a deficiency, but let's make sure they're getting the optimum levels. So, you know, just as simple as grabbing your feed tag, knowing what your horse's body weight is, do a little math, like my son's doing algebra right now downstairs, and see, you know, where you're at. Feeding the correct amount of whatever, you know, that manufacturer is suggesting on the feed tag is kind of the first step. The other thing I would think about, I guess I'm trying to think if, you know, maybe your horse has been sitting idle, but, you know, in 3 weeks you're going to head out and with friends and you're going to go on this week long, you know, trail riding excursion or something. And invite me, please. No. but I would ask them or think about some questions. You know, is he a good traveler? What is his current body condition score? If you know he's not a good traveler, he's going to lose some weight. He's not going to eat as well. Maybe he's kind of on the fence in terms of being in a healthy body condition. Then, yeah, I think that is a good time to, you know, sort of slowly, gradually increase, you know, the grain or the feed, the product that he's getting, as long as it is balanced. So, you know, as an example, if he's eating, you know, 6 pounds a day of, let's say, Safe Choice Original with his mixed hay at Free Choice, and again, he's kind of that example I just described, then yes, I would probably start to gradually kind of bump that up a couple of pounds over a good, you know, couple of weeks and have him there so that, you know, as he travels, you're not losing a drastic amount of weight doing that ride. The other thing you could think about is, rather than just increasing whatever product he's on, you could bring in a fat supplement. If that's the case, again, you're concerned with him losing some calories in the diet, you could do it with a nice, healthy extruded fat supplement as well.
We have a follow-up question from Michelle in our live audience who wants to know, are you recommending regular table salt with iodine or sea salt? Claire, what kind of salt should you be getting?
Either one. I do a lot with iodized table salt. I will say I stay away from iodized table salt if I'm ever putting a diet together for somebody who's feeding any kind of kelp-based product. There are some people that feed, there's, you know, some kelp supplements out there, based supplements. Those are very high in iodine, and I don't need any more iodine in that diet. And so I tend to just use sea salt for those. But the amount of iodine that you're getting from 2 tablespoons of table salt, I tend to find is actually sometimes fairly helpful in the diet. Maybe I need a couple of extra milligrams of iodine, so I find that actually useful.
So I buy my salt at the feed store, and it's just a big bag of livestock salt. I will say that one time, just the kid who loaded picked up the wrong bag of livestock salt, and it was a selenium salt, and so
Ooh.
Took that back, made
Ooh,
sure
dear.
That. I was like,
really
oh,
careful.
That's not right. So I mean, it's important to pay attention because you don't want to overdose your horse on selenium. But I caught it and got the right bag. But it's super, super inexpensive to get that at the feed store. So we have a question for Claire from Isabel in Washington, D.C. She wants to know what you think of feeding straw as a partial replacement for hay. Do you have any thoughts on straw? I know in Europe, straw is used quite a bit.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, I grew up in England, and, you know, it's not more common, I think, on the continent, you know, France, Germany, than it is in the UK, but we certainly do it in the UK. The difficulty I find here is actually finding straw that I would consider clean enough. it's not, straw can have a lot of spores in it, and be quite dusty, and I don't really consider it clean enough to feed. But yes, in theory, you can feed straw. I don't tend to stay away from wheat straw. It's pretty, it's very shiny, right? When you look at the stems of it, it's very shiny and it's pretty indigestible. But there are times where feeding some amount of, you know, small amount of straw is fine. I mean, it is not going to be particularly digestible. So, more for horses that struggle with weight issues where you're really struggling to keep that 1.5% of body weight in front of them and keep them at a good body weight, it can be a good option there. But yeah, the difficulty is finding kind of food grade straw in inverted commas.
Yeah, I think we at the Horse, we cover a lot of research studies, and coming out of Europe, we see a lot of studies on straw. But what they're talking about, I think it's, you two can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's usually like barley straw, where here in the U.S., I think when we think of straw, we think of wheat straw, which is, you know, some people
right.
fed with it, but the horses are, you know, mm-hmm. yeah, they'll kind of nibble at it, but maybe not really want to eat it. Abby, do you have any recommendations on sourcing appropriate straw for feeding?
You know, we've got a little bit more access here in the Midwest, but it's still, as Claire mentioned, it can get pretty challenging, and the, you know, dust and finding something that is super, super clean is very tricky. I would prefer to find lower calorie hay if at all possible.
Me too.
Something that's more mature. And then, you know, if we can at all possible, I know everybody hates to hear this, but exercise, exercise, exercise.
I know, right? I mean, I see some Timothy hay. Abby, you guys analyze a lot more hay than I do, but you know, I've been surprised over the years looking at Timothy, like some of that Timothy is like over 40% ADF. And which is the indigestible fiber component, and you know, it's pretty stemmy, and you know, to Abby's point, if you can find a mature grass hay, you know, that's been made for horses, maybe the weather was such they couldn't get in to cut it, so it grew for longer, and therefore it's more stemmy, but it's clean because it was grown for horses, that probably is a better choice.
So Claire mentioned, or Abby mentioned exercise. So I'm going to give this next question to Abby. It's from Susan in Vermont, and she wants to know, how much exercise does my horse need to gradually lose weight? He's on limited pasture, and she rotates pastures, and the horse gets daily turnout. So how much exercise do horses need to lose weight?
More than we think they do, right? Unfortunate answer. Yep. You know, I would say every horse is going to be an individual. To me, it's, you know, start small, right? So if the horse hasn't been doing any exercise, we've got to gradually work him up. But, you know, I think Claire gave a great description of kind of what that recreational level even looks like of, you know, 45 minutes of work and then maybe a day of rest. You know, I think we were kind of joking about this the other day about, you know, even just starting with walking your horse, you know, all of us, I need more exercise. I need to go for walks. And it encourages me to start, you know, taking my horse on walks so that they can start to get some more exercise in. So I love that you said something about rotating pastures, or it sounds like the horse has turned out, but maybe not doing any forced exercise yet. So just starting small, you know, ponying the horse if you can off with another horse is another great idea. But, you know, trying to work up gradually, maybe starting with 10 minutes a day and just bumping that up every week a few minutes.
I spent a season a couple years ago conditioning with endurance riders, and it gave me a whole another level of appreciation for how much work a horse can do. Mm. So my yeah. horse is ambling down the trail is not the same as getting out there and doing trot sets to build condition. I think our horses are much more capable than we give them credit for if we condition them slowly. You know, you don't just go out and do a 25-mile ride, but build up to it. And as a rider, you get stronger too. So
yes, our cores. I had to laugh to that note. A friend of mine just went from showing pleasure horses to showing reiners. And so she got her first reiner this year. And I was, you know, what's the biggest change you feel like? And she said, I just don't get it. I, you know, it used to take me 20 minutes to get my horse out and ride and kind of get my work done for the day. And these reiners, it's like a 2-hour process to get through all the maneuvers and the exercises. So I had to laugh.
Yeah.
But yeah, they are definitely capable of more than we think they can do.
Yeah. We have a question from the live audience. Claire, I'll give this one to you. It's from Bonnie, who has an 18-year-old Lipizzan gelding who has a history of entroliths, and she's gotten mixed advice on whether her horse should have alfalfa. Can you touch on why that horse may or may not need to eat alfalfa, or should eat alfalfa with that history?
Has the horse had entroliths before, or she's just concerned about entroliths?
He has
had entroliths before.
From the question, it seems like the horse has a history of them.
No, I mean, it is the, you know, there's something about alfalfa that you know, we know is more likely to cause like the struvite crystals that result in the entrolith forming. And so that's why we generally recommend staying away from alfalfa with horses that have a history of entrolith. I typically, in the rations I put together, if I'm putting alfalfa in a ration, I don't put more than 25 to 30% of the total forage as alfalfa. Partly for the entrolith concern, partly just because it ends up being a very high protein, high calcium diet if I put more than that in. And with it being an Iberian bred horse, those horses are typically fairly easy keepers as well. And alfalfa is a higher calorie per pound feed, hay. And so, if generally I've worked with quite a number of Iberian horses and they generally are pretty easy keepers. And so, going back to Abby's point about always wanting to keep 1.5% of their body weight of hay in front of them during the day as a minimum, the higher the calorie content of your hay, the harder that is to do because, every pound, the higher the calories per pound, the fewer pounds you can feed you need to meet their requirement. And so then it's a struggle to then put enough forage in front of them. So those easy keeper breeds, and I put the Iberian breeds in that bracket, I'm looking for grass hays, I'm looking for slightly later maturity hays, hays where I can keep the calories as low as possible, but honor that need for at least 1.5% of body weight per day. And I struggle to achieve that when I put alfalfa in those rations. Now, if that horse is like, I have Iberian breeds that do dressage at a pretty high level, those horses, yes, I'll put some alfalfa in the diet, but they're working 5-6 days a week, doing pretty high level dressage and working pretty hard.
So I think one of the reasons Bonnie was considering feeding alfalfa is the horse has a history of gastric ulcers. So Abby, do you have any recommendations besides alfalfa for feeding horses with gastric ulcers? Because those of us who, it seems like we all have an ulcery horse, and alfalfa does tend to be good for them. But if they can't have it, then what options do you have?
So alfalfa, right, does have that higher calcium content and does a great job of buffering, but can be associated with some calories as well. Certainly from a gastric ulcer perspective, you could feed just a small amount of alfalfa, prior to a ride. We talked about having kind of that hay mat in the stomach from a buffering standpoint. Another thing you can do, obviously having some kind of hay even is going to help. So fed in a nibble net, even if it is lower in calories. There are some products on the market that do have like a marine sourced calcite in them. And what that does is help again to buffer that stomach acid. So perhaps looking into one of those. We actually make one, it's called Empower Digestive Balance. And so it's working to, again, buffer that stomach acid that's continuously secreted. It has also a zinc butyrate in there because we know that that helps to improve the tight junctions as well within the intestinal lining. And I don't think you were asking about starch and sugar, but obviously the total diet we want to keep with a nice controlled starch and sugar intake and per meal as well with those horses.
Yeah. And I think it's important with horses that do suffer with gastric ulcers. It's not just the performance horses that have them, right? Abby, do you have an idea? There's a percentage, isn't there, of recreational horses that still have them? Like, I think it's like 60%, even though they
aren't that's one of the numbers. There's several different studies and numbers, but yeah, that 60% kind of sticks out there too. I always tell people too that, right, like every horse is going to handle, just like people, we all handle stress differently. And so even if we're talking about a recreational horse that, isn't being shown at a high performance level, just that act of, getting on the trailer to go to a trail ride can certainly be stressful, and they can definitely suffer from gastric ulcers as well.
So we have a question from our live audience, and I think this is the last one we're going to be able to get to. Claire, Cheryl wants to know if you have some do's and don'ts for soaking hay. So can you touch on why someone might want to soak hay and then recommendations for how to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. So yes, if you need to be feeding your horse a low starch, low sugar diet because they have like insulin dysregulation or maybe they have PSSM type 1 or something like that, and you are not able to test your hay, you don't know what the starch and sugar content is, we generally recommend you soak that hay because it helps to dissolve out some of the water soluble sugar that's in there. Or maybe you have a hay and it's tested and it's slightly above that magic 12% we talked about earlier that we're all striving to get to and rarely ever achieve. So it will help lower the sugar content, the water soluble sugar. Now, will it lower it down below that magic 12? You know, we don't know unless you were to test it again, but we know it will be lower than it would be if you hadn't soaked it. So that's why we typically recommend soaking it. And there's been a lot of studies in, you know, soaking hay. And I generally recommend people soak for about 30 to 60 minutes. If you have warmer water, you can soak for the kind of lower end of that, sort of the 30 minutes. If your water's cold, you can kind of 60 minutes. And Abby might be aware of some other research that I'm not aware of, but that's kind of where I tend to go with that. There's also research that shows, you know, that's looking at has looked at the same hay, soaking it for, you know, that length of time, 4 hours, 12 hours, 24 hours, and what we find is the longer you soak it, you do start to then leach out some things that you actually want to keep in the hay. The other time you might actually want to soak hay is if you have a horse that has HYPP and you need to lower the potassium. Soaking for longer will get rid of some of your potassium, but if you need to do that, I would work with a nutritionist to kind of, you know, you're going to have to balance, put some other things back in there that might also come out as well. But I just wanted to throw that out there too.
Yeah, and always make
If
sure
you,
to toss the water.
oh
I
yes,
just say that
absolutely,
it
because all
seems
the
like
sugar's in the
common
water.
sense, right? That's where the sugar has gone. But I've actually heard of a couple situations where the owner actually then gave the horse the water. So
Oh,
something to be aware
and
of.
no, don't do that. And also don't, you know, I've spent some time working with, you know, people that work in, I can't think of the right word now, but certainly where Michelle is up in the Pacific Northwest, they have very stringent water quality rules, and that water you've soaked off is essentially effluent, right? So be careful too where you put it off. Don't just like dump it on the ground, especially if you have water courses near you or not, you know, streams and things, because it can contaminate your water courses. So it needs to go down a drain, and not just be, you know, it needs to be careful with what you're doing with it. Soaked hay needs to be fed. You know, you soak it. I recommend put it in a net and then soak it because I was a groom when I was in college, and let me tell you, that is a mess when you soak hay and you don't have it in a net, and then you're trying to like it's like trying to get spaghetti out of a bowl of water. I mean, it's just a disaster. Put it in a net, put it in the bucket, put something heavy on top of it. It needs to be completely submerged, right? So like a brick or something, make it sure it's totally under the water. You know, if it's in a net, you can then hang it up. I've seen some great places where they've put like a hook system where like or a winch or whatever, and they'll like hang it up and then let it drip into the bucket they were soaking it in to contain that dripping water, so that it's not like actively dripping when they like take it in the stall. Because again, depending on where you live, you can end up with like cold ice on the ground and things. So you need to be a little bit from a safety standpoint, just be careful of that. You don't want to leave it soaking for a long period of time either, because it will start to go, you know, you have a mold issue. So you need to make sure that the horses actually consume all the soaked hay. So if you put it in the morning and then you come back at night and there's some left, I would recommend taking that out and getting rid of it and then put your fresh hay in. I've seen some people where they've, you know, put new wet hay in a feeder on top of the old wet hay, and after a few days, it's pretty disgusting. So yeah, you need to get rid of whatever they don't eat. The other reason to soak hay is if your horse has allergies and has issues with dust, you can soak your hay. It'll cause the dust spores to swell up so that they're not then able to breathe them in. So that's another time to soak hay, but you don't have to soak it quite as long. If that's your sole purpose for soaking, you just have to soak it and get it all wet all the way through. But again, you know, for them, I'd say like 30 minutes and you'd be fine.
Yeah, and that's my only experience with it is with a horse that had asthma and wetting it down so it wasn't dusty. But when you get into soaking the hay, it just adds a whole nother level of management, especially in cold climates, if you're fighting with freezing, and in hot climates, you're fighting with it spoiling.
Yeah.
So, my hat's off to people who have to do that to manage their horses. I haven't, knock on wood, had one that I've had to do it with yet.
And it's hard to some people, you know. I mean, I live out, you know, you're in the Pacific Northwest. I'm in the, you know, in Arizona, California, you know, Western states that are really struggling with drought right now. A lot of barns, you can't soak, right? There's not the water available to soak. It goes through a lot of water. And so it can be really difficult for people who are being told that they need to soak their hay. And so if you're in that situation, you know, reach out to a nutritionist who can maybe help you find some low NSC alternatives. Or if you have a horse that you need to soak for allergy reasons, you might want to consider steaming instead.
Yeah. Hay tests are generally fairly inexpensive, you know, $20 to $30, and well worth it when you're in that situation where you need that low NSC hay.
Yep.
Well, sure. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. We've actually gone over a little bit. So thank you for sticking with us for a few extra minutes so that we could get to that last question. I want to thank both Claire and Abby for joining us. This has been a great conversation. I could talk nutrition with you guys all the time. It's really been a great conversation.
I know, it's fun, isn't it?
It is. It is.
So, well, it's been a pleasure. It's been great fun.
Yes, thanks so much for having us.
I also want to thank our sponsor, Nutrina, and I want to thank everyone for joining us live and for listening, and those of you who download us during the podcast later on. Until next time, from all of us here at The Horse, have a great night.